This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/in touch. Good evening. Three chief executives on the programme tonight. A brand new one, a former one, and one with the campaigning bit between her teeth. We're looking at how the visual impairment charities spend the money they raise and why some people think it's going to the wrong places. And we're going to meet one of the few visually impaired chief executives, although not running a visual impairment charity. Neil Heslop's my guest today. Neil, new chief executive officer of Leonard Cheshire Disability. Why did you want it and why do you think you got it?
It's a profoundly personal thing for me. I mean, I lost my sight when I was about 20 in my first year of university. But throughout all of my business career, as a volunteer, I became involved to help organisations out who were seeking to improve the lives of people with visual impairment and disability more generally. And that's something that's always been really, really important to me. And about 3 or 4 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, I made the career choice to kind of move sectors and, if you like, turn my passion and my hobby into the day job.
OK, and why do you think you got it?
Why do I think I got it? Well, I think over the course of the last 25 years, I think I've achieved a track record of being able to lead transformational change in very large, complex organisations. That's what I've done all of my career. And I think that experience and those skills were felt to be valuable given the nature of the challenges that we have at Leonard Cheshire.
OK, we'll hear more later in the programme. But first, charities dealing with blindness and partial sight raise a little over £750 million a year in the UK, but only a very small proportion of that goes on medical research, just £1.5 million on macular disease, for example. But a report just out from the Macular Society says that if we don't make a concerted effort to find a cure for age-related macular disease, or AMD, we face a major funding crisis, not to mention millions of people experiencing avoidable blindness. AMD affects people's central vision, and it's easily the biggest cause of blindness in developed countries, more cases than all other causes of blindness put together. So why don't more of the visual impairment charities spend some of their money on finding its cause? I put this question a few weeks ago when talking to the RNIB's retiring chief executive, Leslie Ann Alexander.
RNIB took a decision not to get into funding medical research some years ago. And I think that was where we drew the line between the here and now and the future. So we don't put money into medical research and we have no plans to do so. We do put quite a lot of energy and effort and therefore some money into eye health issues. So the easy things that people can do to prevent avoidable sight loss.
Leslie Ann Alexander. Well, I've been discussing this new report with Cathy Yelf, Chief Executive of the Macular Society, and I asked her why she thought the situation was so serious.
Really because of the demographics of society and our ageing population. So at the moment, today there are roughly 600,000 people who have sight loss as a result of macular degeneration, and that will double by 2050 to well over 1 million people in the UK with severe sight loss as a result of macular degeneration. And although it is at the moment the biggest cause of sight loss in the developed world, it is actually also the third biggest cause of sight loss globally. And it's estimated that by 2040, there will be nearly 300 million people with sight loss caused by AMD. It is an absolutely global epidemic, which we do need to do something about.
So who is this report aimed at? Who are you trying to influence here?
Well, we're asking a whole range of people to consider the report and think about their response, really. We're aiming this at people who have macular degeneration, the clinicians and the researchers who work in the field, really to raise awareness themselves about the lack of biomedical research into macular degeneration. We're aiming it at other charities in the sight loss sector who currently don't fund biomedical research. Most charities in the sector do not fund medical research, and that is extremely unusual in health charities. It needs to be on the government's agenda. This is a big social and enormous public health problem, and it needs to have some investment now.
So clearly, we do have to do something about this. The question is, should it be the visual impairment charities? Because surely the vast majority of these, including your own, have been set up to help people with existing current problems.
Well, the Macular Society was actually set up with twin purposes, to support people who have the condition today, but also to fund research to find better treatments and a cure. And when we were set up 30 years ago, of course, there was virtually nothing at all that was available in medical treatment terms. Of course, there are lots of, hundreds of charities in the sight loss sector who have been set up to support people, and they do a marvellous job. This is no criticism of the sector. It is a peculiarity, though, that it is the only health charity sector that does not fund medical research. It is unique in that respect.
So how is what you're suggesting, how would it actually work? Are we talking about charities banding together? Are we talking about them siphoning off some of their money for this? Or are we talking about a completely separate charity which would concentrate on funding on the prevention of eye disease?
Well, just to be clear, we're not saying that it is the charity's responsibility to fund all the eye research. We're not saying that. What we're saying is that at the moment, there's about £3 billion in the UK is spent on medical research every year. And in the year 2014, which was a year we looked at, a snapshot, but not an untypical year, of that £3 billion, about £6 million was being spent on macular degeneration. £6 million out of £3 billion. That's about one-fifth of 1%. Now, if you look at the income for the charity sector, as you say, about three-quarters of £1 billion is the income, of which about £1.5 million was spent on macular degeneration research, by far the biggest cause of sight loss. So what we're saying really is that across the board there is insufficient investment in AMD research, and we're trying to raise awareness of this now, because if we wait until we have 1.3 million older people blind because of macular degeneration, it'll be too late.
Cathy Yelf. Well, my guest today is another chief executive, Neil Heslop. You're here mainly to talk about your new job, but you've worked in the visually impairment field with the RNIB, and you've been a volunteer as well. What's your reaction to that interview and this apparent conflict between the here and now and the future?
I'm not sure I see it as a conflict, to be honest, Peter. I think all organisations have to have a point of view about where they focus. So, I mean, there are organisations like Fight for Sight whose whole raison d'etre is to channel research funds into pioneering medical research. As we've just heard from Leslie Ann at RNIB, the very clear decision was taken to prioritise the support for services. And I think that while the issues that Cathy raises are incredibly important for us in society, because they, you know, they really speak to huge demographic changes that are being experienced across all of society, I think individual organisations have to take a view as to where they put their focus.
And that's the point, isn't it? And are we perhaps operating on the basis of what used to be the truth, and now things have moved on with the demographic time bomb? £3 billion spent on medical research, £6 million on AMD. Don't we have to react to that in some way?
Well, I think we in society have to find a way to direct more funds into research that solves problems for the long term. I'm not sure that is the role of all charities who happen to be supporting people living with sight loss.
OK, let's talk about your new job. It's a big one. We've been peeping into your diary.
This is your week. On Monday, you're attending the Customer Action Network event in Birmingham. There you will have discussions on customer engagement and how it will feed into the strategic review. And on 31st of October, it's the Disability Charities Consortium. They're meeting with Penny Morden, Minister for Disabled Persons. On the 10th, you've got a meeting in Edinburgh with the Scotland team, and then heading back mid-afternoon for the Stelios Award Ceremony for an early evening.
Flying back.
Yeah.
Leonard Cheshire Disability is the second largest disability organisation in the UK. £160 million budget, operates in 16 countries, involves negotiating with government ministers. How do you get to grips with a job like that, Neil? You know, you sit at your desk the first day. I would panic. What did you do?
Well, I didn't panic. I suppose, Peter, you know, over the course of one's career, you build up confidence from the experiences that you have. You find solutions to all of the myriad of day-to-day things. And while my appointment at Leonard Cheshire certainly Leonard Cheshire is a big organisation, it's actually quite a substantially smaller organisation than others that I've led in the past. From my business career, where I was working in North America, running a mobile phone operator called Cincinnati Bell Wireless. I think the scale and breadth of that organisation and O2, where I worked before, were substantially larger. So I guess I'm not intimidated by the prospect of being accountable for a 160 million quid and 7,000 people.
So when you do a job like this, do you do your own research? Because I take it you've got the ability to do so. Or do you say, Smith, bring me this information? And he does. Or she.
I think that's a slightly Dickensian perspective on the modern working environment, Peter. But I guess, you know, perversely, the more senior you get in organisations, the more support you get.
Ah, well, that's what I was wondering, because it's something I've always argued. You know, it's easier to be at the top, in a way, once you get there, if you're disabled, than it is to be at the bottom.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think the toughest job of all to get is your first. Because at that point, you're having a conversation with very often a sceptical line manager who perhaps has no meaningful experience of dealing with what you're talking about. And you haven't got a body of experience to be persuasive in reassuring them that you can actually do the job.
It is new ground for you, though, this, isn't it? Because although you've worked in visual impairment, Leonard Cheshire covers disability across the board. You know, it runs residential and day centres for people with a whole range of quite complex disabilities. Does your own disability of blindness make you any better fitted to do this job than anybody else, including a non-disabled person?
Well, I mean, I'm the person I am, and I'm a product of my experiences, and those experiences, are a mixture of all sorts of things. Yes, there's the perspective of having lived with a disability myself for 30 years, and clearly that helps me view some of the challenges that I face in this new role through a particular lens. But equally, the experiences that I've gained in a work environment across a number of countries are also incredibly helpful. It's actually quite difficult to disaggregate the bits that are really relevant to one's experience from disability and one's experience just from the roles that I've had through the course of 30 years.
You've always been very interested in employment. Indeed, you've founded Blind in Business to help visually impaired people get better jobs while still in your 20s. Leonard Cheshire's been criticised sometimes for not having enough disabled people amongst its 7,000 workforce. Only about 300, I think. That's a challenge for you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in 2016, it's totally unacceptable for a disability charity such as ours to have such a small representation. And it's something that I am very committed to changing.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, for a start, we're going to start measuring it. And we're going to make that a really important metric that the leadership group pay attention to. My experience in large organisations is what gets measured gets managed. While I was at RNIB, I had exactly the same experience where the part of the RNIB that I was responsible for, we employed 8% of people with a visual impairment. And simply by putting it on the management agenda, after 3 years, we employed 15.
Because that percentage of Cheshire is about... It's around three, isn't it?
I think it's somewhat more than that. I think one of our challenges within Cheshire is we don't have the systems and processes to accurately measure. So you've quoted the 312. It's not less than that. I'm actually very confident it's probably more than that. But the reality is we don't know, and that's totally unacceptable.
So how are you going to measure your success at Cheshire? What do you need to do you think?
One of the challenges for Leonard Cheshire is we are one of the best kept secrets in town. We do all sorts of things that no one's got any idea that we do. I have yet to meet anyone outside of the building who understood that we are, in effect, a specialist international development agency.
Because what a lot of people think you are is an organisation that keeps people in institutions in decaying mansions.
Yeah, I know. That is exactly what many people speak of, think of us as. And our social care operation is a very substantial part of what we do. It is certainly the case that across our portfolio of about 180 facilities across the UK, there are examples of larger care settings that actually need to be modernised. So that is part of our reality. That is absolutely part of the challenge that I have.
Modernised or closed?
I think modernised, Peter. I mean, I think when you look at individual places, inevitably from time to time across such a diverse portfolio, there will be a requirement to close places that are no longer appropriate for a modern day setting.
There is an irony, surely, Neil, in the fact that you've taken on this job at precisely the moment when a similar job has become vacant at the RNIB. I ask you this because listeners have asked us. You were brought in to solve technical and budgetary problems at the RNIB. Did you not covet the job of CEO there?
I'm not sure what coveting quite means.
Want it.
You can't apply for a job that isn't advertised, Peter. I was approached about the Leonard Cheshire opportunity. As I went through that recruitment process, I learned all sorts of things about the organisation. My chair at Leonard Cheshire is new to the organisation and has been there a little over a year, a lady called Sally Davis. She's a deeply impressive woman who described a very compelling vision for the challenge that we have. So I'm absolutely thrilled to be given the role that I have at Leonard Cheshire. And that's where my focus is.
You could, of course, have been offered the RNIB's jobs or at least asked if you were interested. Didn't that happen?
No, it didn't.
So you went to Cheshire.
You can only accept a job that's offered, Peter.
Yeah. I mean, I say this because, you know, there are people who contacted us saying, why isn't Neil going for this job? These are blind people, you know, with sort of who know what you've done at the RNIB. But that's your answer. You can't go for a job that wasn't there, wasn't offered.
No, and listen, you know, this conversation sort of has a sense of a negative motivation. I've made a very positive decision to go for the job that I've been entrusted with. I feel extraordinarily honoured to being given that privilege. I've got a massive task on my hands, and that's what I'm putting my shoulder towards.
Neil Heslop, thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Do contact us with your views on anything in the programme. Our action line is on 0800 044 044 for 24 hours after the programme. You can email intouch@bbc.co.uk. And if you're able to go online, you can find more information and you can download a podcast of tonight's and subsequent programmes. From me, Peter White, my guest, Neil Heslop, producer Cheryl Gabriel and the team, goodbye.